What's up, everybody? Daryl Freitas, the club CEO here, and we have another amazing episode of the My DJ Story podcast brought to you by the Club app, the number one online community for DJs. We can stream for free and not get cut off. Today, we have DJ Halo with us. Brother, can you please introduce yourself to the people where you're from and who you are?
Cool. What's up, man? Thanks for having me on, and I appreciate the opportunity. My name is DJ Halo, aka Jeep Ward, and I have been a DJ for over 20 years. I started DJing when I got a terrible DJ in a box setup from my parents for, I believe it was my 17th or 18th birthday. And, you know, I had the Gemini BDX-10s, which are the belt drive, like, lowest rung. But I did also have the DJ Jazzy Jeff Scratchmaster mixer, which was a Gemini mixer. And that was, like, top of the line at the time. But anyway, so what started was well before then, music was my life. You know, I was a huge radio fan. You know, I had the radio on every night, no TV. And just, you know, loved music because, you know, I've had a very up and down childhood. So I always knew how music was going to make me feel. And that being said, getting into hip hop, especially as a young man, like I was just so mad, like for no reason. I grew up in a pretty affluent area of Connecticut, but I was just, you know, full of hormones at a very young age and just mad. You know, so I latched on to rap music specifically because I was like, you know what, these dudes have like a real quantifiable reason to be angry. So, you know, I felt like listening to them could sort of help me in somehow, or at least, you know, teach me something. And it definitely did. You know, the somewhere in between It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back and Straight Outta Compton is a real message that I think a lot of people tried to gloss over at the outset of when hip hop became a viable pop format. You know, it was telling the stories of things that were going on in areas that a lot of the country that was drawn to that music would never, and probably in their life never go see in person. But they needed to be advised of what the news was in those areas. And yes, there was like, you know, some moral unclarity as to the, you know, glorification of violence and misogyny and all that. But at base level, it told America what was happening in the hood. And that was, to me, the most important thing, is being like a harbinger of like, yo, America is not all good, son. Like, you need to take a look at where it is. And if you look at like the writings of like somebody like Iceberg Slim or something like that, he outlines how you know, in the boom area of the 50s, where like suburban expansion, etc., inner city America was like completely racked by incredible social issues that just get glossed over. So again, it was like circling back and being like, hey, remember the urban areas? They're still not okay. Wow. So, and then through hip hop, you know, becoming more attuned to like how it was put together and what the importance of a DJ was to hip hop. I think that the real galvanizing factor that made me be like, okay, I really want to be a DJ, was both the turntablist movement of the early and mid 90s, as well as the rave movement of the 90s. You know, I was a big drum and bass and jungle kid, like so many sweaty weekends, like in the jungle room. So seeing how rave DJ, like in person, seeing how rave DJs like control the crowd, and then seeing these videos of like these incredible like turntablists, like early Invisible Scratch Pickles, like this is like when people were like, DJ Q-Bert, who's that? Like, you know, like these were when like Mixmaster Mike and Q-Bert and like the X-Men were like winning their first battles, you know. So all of that combined to make me be like, I want to be part of this. Like, I want to get beyond being just a listener and an aficionado of hip hop and being part of the culture.
That's an amazing intro, man. And it's really great to hear that, you know, you found comfort in hip hop, and that comfort really sparked your interest in getting more involved. And like you said, not just being a listener, but being a participant of hip hop by, you know, getting into DJing. So I'd love to hear, you know, how did you transition and make that transition from just a listener to becoming a participant and picking up the skill of DJing?
So I just sort of researched how to get turntables. What would the cost be? Almost everybody I spoke to, because I knew kids who were older than me in the rave scene, who were like trance and house and jungle and drum and bass DJs, and they all had, you know, Gemini mixer with Technique 1200s. But they were like, you know, you can go down to Canal Street and try and bargain or whatever. And I'm like, how much would that be? And they're like, I don't know, like, a good deal would be like $350 for one turntable. I'm like, $350, what? So, you know, so I looked around for other options, and eventually came to this like $300 complete setup thing from, I want to say it was Music Factory, but you know, it was two belt drive turntables, a Gemini mixer, headphones, like a mic, and like maybe some slip mats, or it didn't come with needles. You had to get your own needles. So it was an interesting intro to like being like, okay, and getting a feel of what it was like. And what I didn't realize is like when I got music, like all I wanted to do was scratch. Like that's all I wanted to do. I didn't really think about, even though I was like a big raver, and like mixing is so important, especially to like jungle and drum and bass, but mixing didn't even come onto my radar for like the first like 4 years I was DJing. So it was an interesting transition to becoming like seeing myself as being part of the culture rather than just being like a viewer of it. And I think that the like sort of underground hip hop like backpack movement really helped me to feel much more attuned and involved in the culture, because I was going to school in Long Island. All these like underground rap kids who were like coming out through like hiphopsite.com and undergroundhiphop.com, like, you know, the anti-con movement as well as Def Jux movement, like all these people were like out at shows and accessible. Like you could roll up on any of them and talk to them, chat with them, trade emails with them, and they were like cool to talk with, you know. I mean, some of them didn't answer, some of them did, but you know, that sort of close-knit society and everything at that time before the vinyl boom was coming out on vinyl. More stuff was coming out on vinyl that was relevant to what I liked than it is now, simply because vinyl is so much more expensive. Back then, you could produce a record, like you could get 1,500 pieces of vinyl for $1,500, because there were, and it didn't take very long to turn around because there was just no demand, really, you know? So like those things in my like formative DJ years, feeling like I was part of a real community, you know, helped me to sort of carry along. And I like knew other DJs at school, and we would like get together and scratch or whatever. But, you know, for the most part, I've been like a dolo DJ, for the most part, like, you know, pretty much existing in a vacuum. Like I had my friends growing up, they were all DJs somewhat, like we would just get high and scratch, but you know, like none of them really pursued it in the same way that I did. Whereas like I came out on the other side of college. Okay. So college, do you need to break in at any time to like, cause I like, there's a defining story in my college that sort of splits up my DJing from like formative to moving on. So is there any like anything you need to say in between?
No, just okay. You're telling a really amazing story. Cool. I do want you to touch on, like, you know, you said you did it dolo, and it's really tough to do it by yourself. So did you have any help, assistant, mentorship, or teachers that helped you in your early journey?
No, I had absolutely zero. And I'm not saying that like, oh, I did it myself, I'm, you know, blah blah blah. Like it's just how it shook out. Like I you know, to this day, I want to, you know, I want to be friends with and like hang out with DJs who are going to inspire me, you know? Like when I was living in the Bay years ago, I was down with like a lot of DJs and we did events together, and that was like a really amazing time for me as a professional. because it was like so rare to have consistent input from somebody where you're like hanging out, sessioning, and they're like, oh, especially somebody who has like real technical knowledge, being like, yo, I see what you're doing, but like, your mechanics seem off. Like, have you worked on that? Like, it was the first time I really thought very, very critically about my technique. But so coming back to college, I had a very, very serious accident happen to me when I was 22 years old. I got run over by two cars in the same incident as a pedestrian. So I was hit by a car, left in the middle of my road, and then run over by another car and dragged under the car for like 50 yards and then spit out from under the car.
Wow.
The fallout of that effect was I like basically bled to death and then woke up like 10 minutes later. All said and done, I tore a bunch of nerves in my left shoulder. So my arm was like totally unusable. I had an operation to reconnect the C5 and C6 nerves in my left arm. And basically they said, there's a 60 to 70% chance you'll get 60 to 70% mobility back. And I was like, okay, cool. So I basically got the top end of what they had recommended. Like, if you see me DJing, you'll notice that like I hold myself kind of strangely, but, you would never be like, oh, that dude's arm doesn't work. I mean, I wouldn't consider myself handicapped by any means. I've figured out how to be functional, but in a very real sense, my left arm does not work as it should. But the biggest thing was that I kept DJing even in spite of it being such a hardship, because it was something that I could dedicate myself to and was directly helpful to my rehabilitation of my arm. So when I told my my therapy people, I was like, so like I do scratch DJing where like I have to move my arm back and forth a lot. And they're like, do that as much as you can. Seriously. So basically like DJing became a part of my physical therapy routine to help rehabilitate my arm. So after about like a year and a half of physical therapy, I was able to like get back into, DJing and pursuing it and going out. Cause I was like doing paid gigs in college. There was like a bunch of really funny spots that I DJed when I was in college. One of them was hilarious. It was a spot that must have been a money laundering place for like these good fellas. Cause like before I came there, they were like, there was never anybody in there. And then I came there and like started promoting, and campus kids started coming and then started patronizing beyond when I was there. My other friends started doing DJ nights. So they all of a sudden started like really making money. And I think that they were like unprepared for it. They're like, what the hell? Kids are coming in and buying beers. What the? So it was kind of a funny thing. Like I would come into practice in the afternoon because I would just leave my gear there. And they'd be like betting on horse races, like using the payphone. So yeah, that's Long Island for you. Getting beyond my injury, I got out of school. I got a radio degree. So I was like a 4-year degree in audio radio engineering, because I figured like being a DJ, like, radio was a good path for me. I got out and ended up, coming back to the general area where I was from or where I graduated from high school, and getting an assistant engineer job. And then finding my feet as far as like DJing goes. I had a friend who I had made through doing like a turntableless mix show on a local college station, who would like book some events for me. And then I started getting involved in a crew in New York City called Mindspray Crew, and doing like a lot of events. Like by the time I quit working and went on tour, I was like sleeping like 10 hours in a given work week, which is like, that's insane. It's really hard to run on that little sleep, especially driving so much. Cause I was like driving in and out of New York. Wow. So much that like, the hour drive, there were times where like literally I'd be like, I'd be like hallucinating. Like I could see a hallucination like break up into like what it actually was. And I'm like, oh my God, why was I seeing that in my mind? But so that was like my first real taste of, you know, getting in and like dedicating yourself to the art while still understanding that like you have to pay your bills and everything. So at a practice for Mindspray, one of the dudes there was like, yo, we're going to be doing a national tour. Do you want to DJ for us? And I was like, yes, I do. So when I quit my job, which was like a good job, actually. I mean, I don't know that it necessarily had a huge future for me, but it was a good job being a video producer for Scholastic. And when I told my boss, they were like, well, damn. I'm like, mad you're leaving, but like, that sounds amazing. You know, because they knew I was an artist and they knew I was a DJ. So it was like I didn't have to like be nondescript about like what I was doing. I was like, yeah, I'm just going on tour and figuring it out after that. And they were like, right on.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what's something that you think stood out about you and your skill set that made you the perfect person to ask to join the tour?
I think the biggest thing that has always been what people notice. I mean, now people notice my skill and I'm like a little bit different. Like a lot of what I do is a little different, like a little, I don't know. My biggest goal is like, I was open format before I knew open format was a thing, right? Like I always wanted to take everything I liked and like crush it into like one dense ball of like a really high energy DJ set. Like if I could do 1 hour of everything I like, like literally 16 bars of like 50 songs in 1 hour, like that would be what I would want, or what I'm working towards as like an ultimate mix goal, right? But so what, even before my skills started to be really honed and sharpened, what always made me stand out, even before I was, you know, a DJ or whatever, is the fact that like when I dedicate myself to something, I dedicate myself to something. It's noticeable. Like people like, this dude has heart. You know what I mean? Like I will tell you, when I first started DJing, I sucked. I sucked so bad. Like, and I was so bad, but I didn't even know how bad I was, which was the worst part about it. Because it's like, if you know you're bad and you know how to improve, then you have a path forward. But if you don't know you're bad and you don't understand how to improve, it's really hard to move forward. So like getting down with like Mindspray and other people where they were like, yo, like, what are you doing? It like totally transformed me as a DJ. And what's interesting is also getting Serato and thinking about BPM all the time drastically changed my DJing as well. And it, frankly, oddly, it helped me to be better at mixing vinyl sets too, because I had a better idea of what I was listening for in terms of tempo record to record. You know what I mean? So it's, I took a lot more out of the switch to a DVS system and then looking back at vinyl only sets than I think a lot of people do. Like I try not to look at my computer all the time. You know, like I want to be using the tools at my disposal, not just constantly like mixing via visual or whatever. But so basically they knew I had heart, I had dedication, and they could count on me to like not fall apart when we're in, you know, 15 days in or whatever. So I think that that's probably what set me apart from other people they were thinking of. And the fact that like I was willing, I mean, the fact that I was willing to just up and quit my job for only a 30 date tour probably said a lot too.
Wow.
So yeah.
Yeah, but no, you have some real heart, man. Strong dedication to the craft and the skill set of DJing, and it's really commendable. And I know that people listening are like, wow, like that really is love for DJing, and that love, you know, has rewarded you with opportunity and just being able to really hone into your craft. So great job on doing that. I would love to hear, you know, kind of where, you know, has your career taken from there, and some of the things that you've been working on recently and things that we can see from you in the future.
Sure. So basically from that one tour, I sort of parlayed that into doing regular shows in New York City and then eventually becoming just like a club DJ in New York City, but also, you know, touring with friends who would say, hey, I'm going to do 20 dates or I'm going to do 30 dates. Like, can you DJ for me? So basically I quit my job and went on tour and like sort of never went back. There was like 18 months where I was general manager of like a 10,000 watt community radio station, which I did because I love that station. I had a show on the station and I was like the hip hop music director of that station. But beyond that, all I did was DJ. For a while it was Thursday, Friday, Saturday in New York City, DJ at night, after party after that, DJ the next night, after party after that. So it was like a 72-hour workday, but then that was all I had to do. So it was like, it was cool, you know, being like in your late 20s, early 30s, and like people are like, oh man, I gotta get up for work. And I'm like, jobs, those are for suckers. You know? So
I love it, man.
Yeah, it was a really great time to be doing stuff and like feeling like I could travel wherever or whatever. I booked my own, you know, a couple tours in Europe, and it's been amazing. And leveraging my radio contacts to be able to develop like overseas gigs as well as gigs elsewhere in the country, you know, being like, oh, hey, you're at Ubiquity Records, can you help me get a gig in San Francisco or whatever? You know what I mean? So, you know, being aware of how to be able to leverage what I had to get something else, or to like talk with other DJs and be like, yo, if you can help me out here, I can certainly get you I can get you on at my spots that I'm doing in New York City or something else. So like being able to also leverage New York City to elsewhere in the country as well as worldwide was also a really helpful tool too. So anybody who's like listening, if you have like a good regular gig that pays, you know, whatever, $150 to $300, and you can leverage that to be like, hey, I want to do 10 dates or whatever, you can tell those people like, you come out here, you know, I'll be able to give you a guarantee of this, and you'll be able to play in front of this type of crowd. Like if you can guarantee that type, or like give them an idea of what they should expect, that's a huge thing to be able to leverage, to be able to get away gigs where you know, sometimes sending a demo and a video is just not enough, or like you won't hear back or whatever. Whereas you need to get a little bit more granular and basically be like, put me on your night. So just a little pro tip there.
Great advice. Yeah.
So while I was DJing, I also became a label manager of a small boutique hip hop label called Fake Four. And as much as my life was pretty dope, living in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and DJing in New York City, I had like a really dope drive time radio show on this radio station WPKN. I just kind of felt like, is this it? Like, is that? Am I done? Like, is there no more? So, my sister had been living in San Francisco for about 10 or so years at that point. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to move to the Bay. So pretty much just up and moved to the Bay. No real reason. I just felt like if I don't move now, I'm going to be a townie, as it were. A townie like DJing in New York City. It would have been fine, but I was just, I felt like there's a whole wide world out there and I need to go live in a different part of it than New England. So I moved to Oakland in 2013 with my girlfriend, and had no plan. Basically was like, I'm gonna go out there, get DJ gigs, maybe bartend a little, or I don't know. And I was still running this label, Fake Four. So I had some income coming in, but it was like not even enough to cover what my apartment was. So You know, I just hustled and like about a month in, I got a weekly gig over at the spot run by an MC by the name of Prozac Turner. He's part of a crew called Foreign Legion. They released records with a bunch of other people. They're like Stone's Throw affiliate type of Bay Area people. But shout outs to my dude, Mark Stretch, Prozac Turner, DJ Design. What's up, y'all? But anyway, I got a weekly over at his spot, and then, you know, developed more and got, you know, more involved in the scene, talking to people, telling people about stuff, and leveraging the fact that I was label manager for this label, you know, which was well known in sort of the underground circles. So a lot of the artists that we were working with, you know, I was able to like sort of leverage either like they know me through the label or whatever. So it was an incredibly helpful thing to be associated with to help further my interest to people in the scene, to like because how it is like you have to have some type of a carrot for people to be interested in who you are when you're new to a scene. Fortunately, I was able to have something like that. I mean, some people don't, and it's like it takes a long time to like get down or like have people like care enough to be like, so do you suck or not, you know?
That's dope, so man, but it's great to hear that you moved to a new city and you were able to make it happen in a month, getting your first, you know, weekly gig. And that's truthfully amazing. You hustled hard and it paid off to you. Like, what are some things that you're focused on, you know, now and some things we could see from you in the future?
So, I live in Durham, North Carolina now. I actually, through the job running the label, now have a job with the distributor of the label. I don't need to get into who it is, but I'm now a label manager, so I manage like 40 plus labels for distribution, and it's awesome. So DJing has sort of like taken a little bit of a backseat to my like, you know, my 5 day a week job, but it's all because of music, and DJing opened all those doors for me. You know, like and what's interesting is people, oh, well, he's not DJing anymore. It's like, no, I'm DJing still. Like, I do a live stream every Tuesday, 8 to 10 on Facebook, Twitch, and YouTube. As well as, you know, I was DJing live regularly before COVID happened. And, you know, I'll be DJing live, you know, once things open up again. It's something that I love and something that I'll never not do. I could never give up DJing. Like I would never sell my turntables, and I have, you know, over 10,000 pieces of vinyl in my house, just because I love music. And I think that's the biggest thing to me is you have to love music. You shouldn't become a DJ to just become a DJ. You should become a DJ because you love music and you want to put people on to music, and you want to be able to provide an atmosphere that, like, I truly believe DJs are therapists, in the sense that, like, on a Friday night, you can have people who got shit on their whole week, and they come out, sweat it out on the dance floor. You play the right series of songs, and that person is going to go home feeling like, hell yeah, I think I can live another day. You know, and that's an important function in society. That's why music venues and DJing, as well as live acts, are important to the health of our society, because those are things that you can't quantify the importance and their function to people's everyday lives.
Wow, brother, you just really dropped some really heartfelt gems. And I think you're right, man. If you really have a passion for it and you really love music and love the craft of DJing, it's something you can't just let go. You know, if you figure out unique ways to allow it to live in your life, whether you're actively DJing or you're passively doing or doing as a hobbyist, DJing is an amazing thing that you can affect the lives of many people with. So kudos to you for what you've accomplished and everything in and around the DJ world. So thank you for what you have done and what you're still doing. Awesome, brother. Yeah, I'd love to take this time to jump into the lightning round. Do you have any last pieces of advice or anything you want to say before we do that?
You know, just be true to yourself, you know, play the music like, you know, whenever somebody finds out you're a DJ, they're like, oh, what do you DJ? And, you know, if you're an open format person, be open format. If you only want to play two-step house, play two-step house. Like, don't feel pressured like, oh, I see a lot of big DJs playing trap, or I see a lot of big DJs playing EDM. If that's not your stilo, Carve your own lane.
Awesome, brother. Let's jump into the lightning round. You ready?
Yep.
Great. Describe your DJ setup, hardware and software.
My DJ setup is two Technique 1200s that I actually saved up all summer back in, like, I don't know, 99 or 98, and bought two black 1200s with my first Vestex mixer, which was a PDX 003. But now I have a Pioneer S9, and I use Serato DJ Pro, like an official copy. I don't use the light.
Besides yourself, who's your favorite DJ?
I would say my favorite DJ is probably Mixmaster Mike.
What has been your favorite party or event you DJed at, and why?
Oh, I will tell you what. My favorite party that I ever DJed at was the South by Southwest 2015 House of Vans. I was the house DJ for the label that I was running at the same time, our showcase. And so we were inside at the Mohawk, and outside was the Rhymesayers 20th year anniversary. And like the VIP, which obviously, like, it was my showcase, so of course I had access, was crazy. I hung out with Buck 65 and Too Short in the same time.
That's awesome, brother. Who is the most interesting person you've met through DJing?
Macaulay Culkin.
What's one thing that you think is missing from live streaming for DJs?
I would say the sort of the body language crowd interaction, where you, because the chat is great, you know, to be able to, like, keep people engaged or whatever, but you don't have any of that, like, unspoken movement, you know what I mean? Like, there's a ton of times where, like, you'll put on a song and you'll see some hard rock, like, lighten up, like, oh shit, you know, like that type of interaction, which is, like, you know, he's probably never going to come up to you and say anything, or, like, you know, when you hear somebody be like, oh shit, that's my jam, that, like, they're not coming up to you and directly talking to you. Like, that's the type of interaction that I do miss from being on live stream.
And shout out any DJs you know personally whose story needs to be shared on this podcast.
I would like to shout out both of my future Shock brethren, DJ Soros and DJ Mark Stretch, both Bay Area DJs, both really out there killing it.
Awesome. We look forward to hearing their stories, and any DJs that are interested in being on the show can sign up at djsignup.com. And brother, where can people find you online or even in person if you're still doing events?
If you want to find me online, just go to www.halodoesntsuck.com.
Love it, man. Everyone, you have listened to DJ Halo on the My DJ Story podcast. This was great, and we look forward to working with you and being in touch, brother. This was great.
Cool, man. Thank you.
Are you a DJ? Well, we want to hire you as one of our official The Club virtual DJs. We've been working hard to source hundreds of paid virtual gigs, and we need DJs of all kinds that are interested in getting paid to curate virtual events for our clients. Whether you're a new DJ just getting started or a veteran in the game, we have paid gig opportunities for you. Text I'm in to 609-201-1027 to get notified for paid gig opportunities from The Club. Tell a friend. We look forward to working with you. Now back to the podcast.